Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the June 16th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is A Palestinian Doctor in Israel Helps People on Both Sides. A letter from Israel. A Palestinian doctor in Israel helps people on both sides. Lina Qasem Hassan treated victims of October 7th. She also publicly condemned the war in Gaza, a stance that imperiled her job, by A.L. Press. In October 2023, a few days after Hamas's attack on Israel, a physician named Lina Qasem Hassan filled her car with medical supplies and drove from her home in Tamra, a town in northern Israel, to the David Dead Sea Resort and Spa in Ain Bokak. Tourism was about to nosedive throughout the country, but the resort was busy, scrambling to accommodate hundreds of evacuees who had just arrived from Kibbutz Be'eri, one of the communities near the Gaza Strip, which Hamas had struck. Qasem Hassan, a family medicine physician, came to help at a clinic that had been set up on the hotel's grounds. She was soon dressing the wounds of injured people and dispensing pills to evacuees who had fled their homes without their medication. The lobby, she told me recently, resembled a refugee camp, with donated clothes scattered in piles and shell-shocked families walking around aimlessly. Yet some of the new guests acted eerily normal, taking towels and going to the swimming pool, Qasem Hassan recalled. It looked like they didn't realize what they'd been through. The clinic stayed open for nearly 2 weeks. Every day, members of the kibbutz gathered in a banquet hall to hear updates about neighbors who had been kidnapped or murdered or were still missing. Sometimes the names of multiple family members were read aloud. 97 civilians were killed at Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th. Although Qasem Hassan was accustomed to treating people who had suffered trauma, the experience tested her emotional endurance. We had to be there to assist people who couldn't stand the situation, she said. The atmosphere would have been difficult for any Israeli physician, but for Qasem Hassan, the challenge was compounded by her background and identity. She is a Palestinian citizen of a country that, in 2018, passed a law affirming that the right to self-determination was unique to the Jewish people. The law had also made Hebrew the country's sole official language, downgrading the status of Arabic. Israel had since installed the most right-wing government in its history, a coalition of hardliners and extremists who were not likely to temper the rage or the desire for revenge that Qasem Hassan feared the October 7th attack would unleash, not just toward Hamas fighters, but toward Palestinian citizens of Israel and residents of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. In subsequent months, reports on the suffering of Gazans were drowned out in Israel by coverage of the hostages' plight. But for Qasem Hassan, the agony was immediate. On October 7th, while she was still at home in Tamra, she heard a piercing cry. It was her sister-in-law, who lived next door. She had just learned from a news report that her brother, Marwan Abdu Reda, a paramedic in Gaza, had been killed when an Israeli rocket struck an ambulance in which he was traveling. Qasem Hassan had met Abdu Reda and visited his family. He often sent her holiday cards. That evening, Qasem Hassan cooked dinner for her relatives and grieved with them. It was terrible, she said. The clinic at the hotel was a collaborative effort that Qasem Hassan had launched with her peers at Physicians for Human Rights Israel, a nonprofit whose board she chairs. The organization, founded in 1988, produces reports on sometimes contentious subjects. A recent one claimed that Israeli prisons were systematically denying medical care to Palestinian detainees, resulting in widespread scabies infections, among other problems. The Israel Prison Service did not respond to a request for comment. The group also provides medical care to people who lack access to it, both in the occupied territories and at a clinic in Jaffa that serves immigrants, asylum seekers, and refugees. In fact, at the time of the October 7th attack, Qassam Hassan and other PHRI members had been planning to visit Gaza the following week. With access to Gaza cut off, Qassam Hassan instead joined an emergency response team and went to the Dead Sea for reasons both personal and philosophical. "You can't divide human pain," she told Palestinian friends, who questioned why she went to the hotel as the bombardment of Gaza intensified. "Whether you are Israeli or Palestinian, it's the same pain." Before leaving the Dead Sea area, Qassam Hassan texted a photograph to a group of colleagues at a medical clinic where she worked in Kiryat Balik, a town on the outskirts of Haifa. It showed her standing in a white coat next to her fellow volunteers. She added a note, "In the PHRI clinic we set up at the David Hotel for evacuees from Kibbutz Be'eri. Very nice," a Jewish nurse at the clinic texted back. "Human rights for Israelis only. For all people," Qassam Hassan replied. "Certainly not," the nurse responded. "Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and anyone who collaborates with them don't have rights because they are not human beings. For all innocent people," Qassam Hassan texted. Qassam Hassan would soon stop expressing herself so freely. Shortly after she returned to Tamra, where she lived with her husband, a sociologist named Sharaf, and their four children, a wave of arrests and investigations swept Israel. Dozens of Palestinian citizens were accused of inciting terrorism, often based solely on their social media posts. To Jewish Israelis, the crackdowns might have seemed like a necessary precaution after the worst massacre in their nation's history. But it felt like unwarranted harassment to many of the targets, including Abed Samara, the head of the cardiac intensive unit at Hasharon Hospital in Petah Tikva, who was suspended without warning for social media posts that some interpreted as pro-Hamas and for allegedly replacing his profile picture on Facebook with a Hamas flag after October 7th. According to Haaretz, the allegation was false. The image was of an Islamic flag, and it had been on Samara's Facebook page since 2002. But once the accusation spread, Samara was barraged with threats. He ended up resigning from the hospital where he'd worked for 15 years. Qassam Hassan, who had sometimes posted opinions about politics on social media, stopped doing so, and she avoided discussing the war at work. But she kept her leadership role at PHRI, which occasionally required her to speak to journalists. In February 2004, she appeared on Channel 12, a popular Israeli news outlet, to discuss the humanitarian situation in Gaza. In an interview with Arad Nir, who hosts a program on international affairs, Qassam Hassan said that Israel had intentionally targeted Gaza's hospitals in violation of the Geneva Conventions, which accord medical facilities a special protected status. Nir pushed back, arguing that Hamas used these hospitals as command centers to launch deadly attacks on Israel. Qassam Hassan replied that this claim had not been verified by a third party and that targeting healthcare facilities violated international law. As Qassam Hassan was aware, such views were rarely voiced on Israeli television. A couple of months later, three of her patients who'd heard the interview sent a letter to her employer, Clarilit, Israel's largest healthcare organization. "The statements she'd made about the bombing of Gaza's hospitals were proof," they wrote, "that her heart was with her murderous Palestinian brethren." The patients called for Qassam Hassan to be suspended in light of her solidarity with and support for Hamas. Many sectors of Israeli society, such as the public school system, are highly segregated. But in Israel's hospitals and health clinics, Palestinian employees actually have an outsized presence. In 2023, 25% of doctors in Israel were Arab, more than double the level in 2010, as were 27% of nurses and 49% of pharmacists. the Israeli medical system could scarcely function without them. After October 7th, a rabbi named Mir Shmuley released a YouTube video in which he portrayed this development as a dire threat. Do you know how many Arab doctors, may their names be erased, are in hospitals? Shmuley asked. He claimed that these doctors were killing Jewish patients, a baseless charge that Zion Hagai, the chairman of the Israeli Medical Association, denounced. Such talk could ignite a war within us, Hagai warned, hailing the country's healthcare system as a beacon of coexistence and tolerance where Jewish and Arab medical professionals work side by side from day to day and have one oath and one goal, saving lives. In recent years, many Jewish Israelis who might have entered the medical field have instead gravitated to the tech industry, sometimes after serving in intelligence units of the Israel Defense Forces. Most Arab citizens are not required to serve in the military and rarely do so. Thebet Abu Ras, a political geographer at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute, told me that Palestinians have rushed to fill the resulting openings in medicine. Abu Ras, an expert on Israel's Palestinian minority, did not downplay the level of racism in his country. If we take the issue of land and planning, there are over 30 different discriminatory laws within the system, he said. The discrimination in Israeli society is very structural. But he noted that Israel has some striking contradictory tendencies. In recent years, the government has invested tens of millions of dollars in scholarships for Palestinian students seeking to attend universities as a way of addressing poverty and unemployment in Arab communities. Abu Ras, a member of the steering committee that oversaw this initiative, told me that the number of Palestinian citizens seeking advanced degrees grew from 24,000 in 2010 to 64,000 last year. In 2016, two nonprofits, the Israel Religious Action Center and the Israel Movement for Reform and Progressive Judaism, published Heroes of Health, a report heralding these changes. A photograph on the cover showed a group of medical workers holding up signs, some in Hebrew, others in Arabic, that read, Jews and Arabs refuse to be enemies. That year, a Pew survey found that nearly half of Jewish Israelis supported expelling Arabs from the country. The report argued that a spirit of collaboration and openness nevertheless prevailed in the field of healthcare. A physician named Seher Asadi was quoted as saying, I feel free in this system and I feel that I can develop and do anything. Medicine, the report suggested, was a neutral space that hospital administrators kept insulated from the headlines, which that year were dominated by stories about stabbings of Jews on sidewalks and in markets. Such acts of violence and retaliatory shootings by Israeli security forces were not discussed at work, according to administrators at several hospitals. Asnat Letzion Korach, the director of Hassad Mount Scopus Hospital in Jerusalem, said that medical staff were expected to leave the politics at the door. In 2018, Guy Shalev, an Israeli anthropologist who is now the executive director of PHRI, published a dissertation arguing that this egalitarian ethos was a fiction. While doing fieldwork at two Israeli hospitals, he discovered that Jewish doctors routinely discussed politics. Only Palestinians had to avoid such talk, he found. To have any chance of getting promoted, a Palestinian medical student noted, people like him needed to convince their superiors that they were Avim Tovim, or good Arabs. The students in question had been arrested at a protest when he was a teenager, but had scrupulously avoided such activity ever since. Although medicine offered Palestinian citizens an entry ticket into Israeli society, Shalev concluded it came at the cost of having to mute their identities. In a study published this past February, Gada Dili, a policy analyst at Al Shabaka, a Palestinian think tank, argued that this burden has grown heavier since October 7th, as the atmosphere in Israeli hospitals has become more overtly nationalistic. A Palestinian doctor told Majadili that at a staff meeting, a Jewish colleague said, "Let them annihilate Gaza," while staring at him. Many of Majadali's subjects feared that pushing back on dehumanizing comments about Palestinians would cause them to be accused of disloyalty or of supporting Hamas. From an early age, Qassam Hassan was encouraged to speak her mind. She grew up in Nazareth, Israel's largest Arab city. Both her parents were teachers, and her mother and aunts all earned advanced degrees. They were among the first Muslim girls from Nazareth to go to college, Qassam Hassan told me, reflecting her father's belief that Palestinian citizens of Israel couldn't afford to waste the opportunities offered by education. As a young girl, Qassam Hassan absorbed the same message from her mother, who drilled her with puzzles and brain exercises. As Qassam Hassan got older, she received an equally formative political education. Her mother took her to rallies at a public square in Nazareth, where she heard speeches by the famous Palestinian Emil Habibi, a novelist and a member of the Knesset, and Tawfiq Zayid, a poet and the mayor of Nazareth. Her mother even made her memorize one of Zayid's poems, which she then recited on stage in front of local dignitaries, including the author. The political culture of Nazareth was dominated by Hadash, an alliance of the Israeli Communist Party and several left-wing groups which championed socialism and Arab-Jewish cooperation. These values were shared by Hossam Kossan's mother, who appeared at strikes even though teachers were not supposed to join picket lines. She wasn't afraid, Qassam Hassan said. After finishing high school, Qassam Hassan enrolled in Hebrew University's medical program, inspired by the fact that a beloved aunt had died suddenly at the age of 31 from a cause that had never been determined. In 2000, during Qassam Hassan's third year, the second Intifada began after the breakdown of peace talks at Camp David. That October, Palestinian citizens of Israel flooded the streets in support of the uprising. The Israeli police opened fire on protesters, killing 13 people, among them Ashel Ashela, the brother of a medical student in the class below Qassam Hassan's. Political activity was barred on the campus of Hebrew University Medical School, Qassam Hassan and her fellow activists were told. Qassam Hassan, who was among the leaders of an organization called the Committee of Palestinian Students, challenged this policy. At one point, she asked the school's dean to explain why he'd said nothing after Ashel was shot. The events of October 2000 confirmed Qassam Hassan's belief that doctors needed to speak out about social issues that affected human health, from police violence to systemic discrimination. Like members of her generation, she became radicalized, bristling at efforts to promote intergroup cooperation, which masked discrimination and inequality. During her time in medical school, however, Qassam Hassan found a mentor in David Applebaum, an ordained rabbi and an emergency medicine doctor who was known for rushing to the scene of suicide bombings to tend to the victims. Applebaum ran a clinic, Terem, that provided urgent care in an ultra-Orthodox community. Qassam Hassan started working there on Saturdays when Jewish staff observed the Sabbath. Qassam Hassan suspected that she and Applebaum held radically different views on most aspects of the Israel-Palestine conflict, including Jewish settlers, several of whom worked at the clinic, but she admired his compassion. In 2023, when he and his daughter were killed in a suicide attack at a cafe, she was shocked and saddened. It was unnerving to be studying in Jerusalem during the second Intifada. Every coffee shop was in danger, Qassam Hassan said. To earn money, she worked at a restaurant in a mall where fans of the soccer team Betar Jerusalem, who are notorious for their anti-Arab racism, sometimes celebrated after games. Qassam Hassan would hear them chant, "Mavet la'Arabim," death to Arabs. Although Qassam Hassan did not wear a hijab and spoke Hebrew so well that people sometimes assumed she was Jewish, she was terrified of being outed and attacked. One day, at the Taram Clinic, a woman humiliated a Palestinian colleague of Qassam Hassan's by saying, "Don't touch my child, you're Arab." At a different facility, Qassam Hassan overheard a nurse say, after an Arab patient had given birth, "You've brought us another terrorist." Palestinian medical residents faced extra obstacles when competing for positions in such fields as obstetrics and gynecology, which was Qassam Hassan's preference. She had strong grades and recommendations, yet she had a hard time finding a hospital that would admit her to its program. She later switched to family medicine and was accepted at the Carmel Medical Center in Haifa. Not long after Qassam Hassan graduated from medical school, her mother died of cancer. At the memorial, Qassam Hassan spoke about the moral values that had been instilled in her. In 2016, she decided to act on them by appearing before the Israeli Knesset to testify about the segregation of Jewish and Palestinian mothers in maternity wards. A scandal had erupted after Israel Public Radio aired a report on the practice, which is forbidden by Israel's health ministry. The controversy grew when Bezalel Smotrich, then a far-right Knesset member, today Israel's finance minister, affirmed that maternity wards should be segregated. "It is natural for my wife to not want to lie next to somebody who just gave birth to a baby that might want to murder her baby in 20 years," he tweeted. At the Knesset hearing, various hospital administrators insisted that pregnant women had to be separated only to respect cultural preferences. It was noted that Orthodox women might not want someone next to them watching TV on the Sabbath. But Qassam Hassan testified that she had frequently seen Palestinian patients receive separate and demeaning treatment, including on occasions when doctors who did not speak Arabic summoned male custodial workers to ask women about their sexual histories. Back in medical school, Qassam Hassan had been doing a rotation in a pediatric ward when she'd overheard an exchange between a Palestinian woman from the West Bank and a Jewish doctor. The woman said that she had had to cross a checkpoint to get to the hospital and asked for a letter that she could present to the soldiers there, who often gave her trouble. The doctor provided the letter and also advised her to contact Physicians for Human Rights Israel. Qassam Hassan had never heard of the organization. She rushed to a computer and found its website. She soon became a regular volunteer. Qassam Hassan was shaken when she heard that some of her patients had written a joint letter accusing her of being a Hamas supporter, but she was not entirely surprised. After finishing her family medicine residency, she'd spent a decade working at a clinic in a prosperous neighborhood of Kiryat Balik. In 2022, she moved to her current clinic, which is in a poorer area. She was eager to serve a less privileged population, but the neighborhood surrounding the new clinic was fiercely conservative. Qassam Hassan responded to the joint letter by sending Khalit photographs of herself treating evacuees from Kibbutz Be'eri. She also sent a link to a radio interview that she'd given shortly after October 7th, in which she condemned both Hamas's attack and Israel's retaliation in Gaza as war crimes. Khalit, after a review, decided to dismiss the complaint against Qassam Hassan. She was relieved, but the Khalit representative who relayed this news to her then noted that her accusers, unappeased, were threatening to stage a protest or go to the media. "The letter's authors declined to speak with me." Other patients warned her that they'd heard negative talk about her in the neighborhood surrounding the clinic. This prompted a security guard from Khalit to offer to walk her to her car at night. Sometime later, another patient at the clinic angrily confronted her about her support for the rights of Palestinian prisoners and told her to move to an Arab country. After this encounter, Qasim Hassan shut her office door and cried. Privately, she wondered if she could continue working in such an environment. But she didn't quit. One morning in February, I visited the clinic, a low-slung building with metal bars over its windows. I passed through a hallway decorated with Israeli flags on my way to Qasim Hassan's office, a small room appointed with family photographs and gifts the patients had given her, a Gaudi figurine from Barcelona, a souvenir from Dubai. Qasim Hassan, who was 47, with chin-length brown curls and a poised bearing, told me that, after the joint complaint was submitted to Clalit, her biggest fear was that a critical mass of patients offended by her politics would switch to other doctors, as the authors of the letter had done. Since her salary depended on the number of people she treated, this could upend her ability to earn a living. She also worried that Clalit might fire her, or that the controversy would damage her relationship with patients to whom she felt close, many of them with backgrounds that were radically different from hers. One day she invited me to accompany her on some home visits. Our first stop was the residence of an elderly couple, Holocaust survivors, she'd been treating since 2014. They sat slumped in recliners in the living room of their apartment. The husband greeted Qasim Hassan with a warm smile. His wife was less animated. For years, she'd struggled with depression, a condition that she attributed to the murder of most of her immediate family during the Holocaust when she was a child in Romania. After I shared that my maternal grandparents were Holocaust survivors from Romania, the man said, "My wife, they killed two sisters and an older brother and another." Qasim Hassan asked the woman if she still thought about what had happened. Of course, she replied. Then she fell silent. Afterward in the car, Qasim Hassan said that she kept trying to get the woman to talk more about her past, since her refusal to do so seemed to exacerbate her suffering. Qasim Hassan had personal experience with victims who were wary of discussing traumatic experiences. During the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from Israel or fled their homes in fear. In the Arab community, this is known as Nakba, or catastrophe. Another 150,000 became citizens of Israel. Many of these 48 Palestinians were also dispossessed, including Qasim Hassan's father, whose family was evicted from the village of Tira. Qasim Hassan told me that her father belonged to the generation of Palestinians who were afraid to talk about the Nakba, a fear reinforced by the fact that Israel kept Arab towns under military rule until 1966 and treated their inhabitants as an enemy within. Before Qasim Hassan visited the home of her next patient, she pulled over at the crest of a hill and led me down a path to an open field strewn with rocks. These were the ruins of a cemetery in Al-Duman, a Palestinian village that, according to several historians, was destroyed by the Israeli army in 1948. The village's 1,500 inhabitants fled, among them the family of Qasim Hassan's husband, who went to Lebanon before eventually returning to the region and settling in Tamra. Qasim Hassan and her husband had taken their wedding photographs by the village's ruins. She showed me a well that had once supplied El-Duman with water. After visiting the cemetery, we continued along a highway that bisects the Galilee. As we passed Tamra, Qasim Hassan pointed out a restaurant and an auto repair shop. Locals sometimes said that these were the only reasons Jewish Israelis visited the town. "We come to Tamra to eat the food, to fix the car. This is coexistence," she said, laughing. In the towns where her Jewish patients live, Qasim Hassan told me the roads were smoothly paved and children played in the parks. In Arab towns, there were few parks, and so children played in rutted streets. Discriminatory land policies had allowed Jewish municipalities to expand while places like Tamra grew ever more constricted. The next house call Qasim Hassan made was in an Arab town called Kabul. After welcoming us inside, three women in headscarves plied us with cashews, dried fruit, and scented coffee. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. They were the daughters of Qasim Hassan's patient, a woman in her 70s. While Qasim Hassan examined her in another room, I spoke to the patient's husband. A small man with a white beard, he told me that in his youth, he taught himself to weave and to paint tiles. Because of these skills, he had managed to earn enough to raise 5 sons and 5 daughters. When I asked where he was originally from, he said Al-Daman, the raised town that Qasim Hassan and I had just left. Then he gestured toward the TV, which showed footage of children wading through rubble in Gaza, and said that it reminded him of his own youth. He was born in 1946, he said, and although he was too young to remember the 1948 war, he vividly recalled its aftermath when his father was expelled to Jordan and he and his siblings were destitute. I cried. I wanted bread, he said. No father, no bread. In addition to having a roster of patients, Qasim Hassan co-taught a medical ethics class affiliated with the Technion Israel Institute of Technology in Haifa. One day in May 2024, the theme of the lesson was the challenge of preserving the dignity of patients. The students were given an article from Haaretz about a doctor who'd served at Seed Taiman, a facility in the Negev Desert that after October 7th was used to detain alleged Hamas fighters and other suspects taken from Gaza. In a letter sent to Israel's health and defense ministers and its attorney general, the doctor wrote that he'd seen detainees blindfolded, made to wear diapers, and placed in painful constraints, conditions that, in his view, violated the incarceration of unlawful combatants law, which Israel amended in 2023. Just this week, 2 prisoners had their legs amputated due to handcuff injuries, which unfortunately is a routine event, the doctor stated. This was in violation of Israeli law, and perhaps worse for me as a doctor, in the violation of my basic commitment to patients. In a statement, the IDF told me that any mistreatment of detainees is strictly prohibited and that concrete allegations of abuse are investigated. The class discussion was tense. A medical resident who was of Palestinian heritage said that he didn't want to talk about the subject because he feared that it was too inflammatory and divisive. Several Jewish students said that they shared his concerns. Another resident, a Jewish reservist who had served at Seed Taiman, insisted that during his time there were detainees that had been treated appropriately and given proper medical care. A week later, Qasim Hassan learned that the School for Continuing Medical Education and Family Medicine, which oversaw the ethics course, had received a letter from several residents in the class. In the letter, a copy of which I obtained, the students criticized the Haaretz article as biased. They also accused Qasim Hassan of dismissing the concerns of the resident who had served in Seed Taiman and abusing her authority by imposing her political agenda on them. 3 days later, another group of students submitted a reply. They acknowledged that the topic was emotionally charged, but they insisted that the conversation had been respectful and that the reservist had been encouraged to express his views. They also questioned why only Qasim Hassan had been singled out for blame. The class had 2 Jewish instructors as well, Hila Yaakov, a medical ethicist, and Amos Ritter, a family medicine doctor. Ritter was not present that day, but he had helped prepare the lesson. The letter was signed by 4 Palestinian residents. The course had been visited by controversy before. Years earlier, after Qasim Hassan had brought in a speaker from PHRI who used the term occupied territories, some students raised objections. Ritter, who admires Qasim Hassan's outspokenness, told me that ever since then, Lena has been marked as a left extremist. Now Kassam Hassan and her colleagues were summoned to meet with Adi Izori Aral and Merav Sadarsky, who led the academic program at the continuing education school. The teaching of explosive issues should be coordinated with the school's leaders in advance, the instructors were told, and the lessons should draw on scientific papers, not on articles in Haaretz, which in Israel is widely seen as left-wing. If Zori Erel and Sadarsky reiterated this in a statement to me, while addressing sensitive topics is not prohibited, such discussions should rely on balanced, nonpartisan academic sources, they wrote. This was not the first time that concerns had been raised about political bias and ethical discussions within the course, they added. Yaakov told me that in hindsight, she wished the discussion had not focused on the Haaretz article. It had, she said, led some students, both Jewish and Arab, to experience it as a political debate rather than an ethical one. In Kassam Hassan's view, bias was not the issue. Rather, the fact of prisoner mistreatment had made some students uncomfortable. Since that day in class, she noted, far more graphic accounts of abuse at Tiemann had emerged, including an incident caught on video in which a group of soldiers appeared to sexually assault a male detainee with a baton. The faculty overseeing the course, she felt, wanted to muzzle discussion of a disturbing reality, which was itself a political choice. Kassam Hassan also felt that she'd been subjected to a double standard. Back in November 2023, Mordechai Alperin, the head of the family medicine program, had signed an open letter endorsing the bombing of hospitals in Gaza that the signatories said were being used by Hamas. Nobody had accused him of political bias, though several Palestinian students had privately complained to Kassam Hassan about it. In a text, Alperin told me he doubted that the open letter had had any impact on the situation in Gaza and argued that there is no place for politics in the medical system. If Zori Erel and Sadarsky had noted that Alperin's action did not take place within the framework of the program. Kassam Hassan had taught the ethics class for 7 years. She had recently learned that Technion would award her a diploma for excellence in teaching, but she no longer wanted to teach the ethics class. I can't teach medical ethics with a sword on my neck, she said. Kassam Hassan's concern for the dignity of patients in extreme situations evolved from her work with PHRI. For years, she'd served as a doctor for Palestinian prisoners who launched hunger strikes to protest being held under administrative detention, meaning that they had not been charged with a crime or a trial. It was one way she could express solidarity with Palestinians who were denied the rights and protections that Israeli citizens had. Another way was dispensing care at the mobile clinics that PHRI operated in the occupied territories. The conditions that Kassam Hassan witnessed on these expeditions helped convince her that Israel's 16-year blockade of Gaza had turned the territory into an open-air prison, a situation that was bound to explode at some point. In early March, I met Kassam Hassan and a group of medics at a gas station in Taib, an Arab town near the Green Line, which separates Israel from the West Bank. A black van had been loaded with donations and supplies, and Kassam Hassan added a bag of winter clothing that two of her children had outgrown. After crossing a checkpoint, we followed a road flanked by sloping hills towards Dinaba, a town near Tulkarm, where Israel had launched a major military operation in January. Its aim, according to Smotrich, the finance minister, had been to root out militants and bolster protection of settlements and settlers. The campaign had displaced 40,000 Palestinians, according to some analysts, the most in the West Bank since the Six-Day War in 1967. The van stopped outside a white concrete building facing a courtyard decorated with the mural of the Smurfs. It was a girls' school. After the supplies were unloaded, Kasim Hassan pulled a medical smock over her black jacket and entered a classroom decorated with diagrams of the digestive system. A throng of patients had amassed outside. For several hours, Kasim Hassan tended to their medical needs, a task made harder by the fact that many had fled Tulkarm without any possessions. A diabetic man with mud-flecked shoes told her that he was missing both his insulin and his eyeglasses. A woman in a gray hijab said that she suffered from depression and anxiety, but didn't know what prescriptions she needed because she left her medicine behind when soldiers evicted her from her home. Then she showed Kasim Hassan a picture of her son, which dangled from a chain around her neck. The son, a young man in his 20s, had been shot and killed by a soldier 4 months earlier, she said. She provided no additional context, but her grief was palatable. Kasim Hassan held her hand, which was trembling, and wrote out a prescription for her. An elderly man in a dark thobe shuffled in the room, pushing a walker. He was with his daughter, who told Kasim Hassan that he had myasthenia gravis, an autoimmune disease. The man waved three fingers in the air, one for each of the times he'd become a refugee, 1948, 1967, 2025. The last patient left at around 2 p.m. It was the start of Ramadan, and everybody wanted to get home before sundown. Kasim Hassan sighed and admitted, "I can't take any more of these stories." On the way back to Taib, we passed a hilltop where some caravans were visible. It was a settlement outpost built with the Israeli government's tacit consent. From Taib, I got a ride back to the Tel Aviv area with Daniel Solomon, one of the other physicians who volunteered at the mobile clinic. Solomon, an Italian Jew who moved to Israel in 2012, works at a hospital in a politically conservative town. The staff is mixed, and when the focus is on treating patients, everyone gets along. There is definitely some degree of coexistence, he told me. But as in most hospitals, the majority of the leadership positions are held by Jews, he said, adding that since October 7th, the atmosphere has grown jingoistic. At the hospital's entrance, staff had hung a banner bearing the slogan, "One people together, we win." A whiteboard and some markers were placed next to it so people could write messages. In no time, Solomon said, someone had written, "Flatten Gaza," alongside, "Am Yisrael Chai, the people of Israel live." That evening, I visited Tel Aviv's Democracy Square, where anti-government protests are held every Saturday. The demonstrations began in January 2023 in response to a plan by the government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to limit the Supreme Court's powers. More recently, the organizers have been targeting the government's failure to secure the release of all October 7th hostages, and the willingness of Netanyahu to appease his right-wing coalition partners by prolonging the war. The streets were crowded with demonstrators, some of whom were dressed in Prime Minister's sweatshirts, a reference to Netanyahu's corruption trial, which centers on accusations that he accepted lavish bribes and discussed doing political favors for a media company in exchange for positive coverage. Others wear war hats bearing the words, "End this fucking war." The mood was more somber at Hostage Square, near the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, reflecting the week's events. A few days earlier, a funeral had been held for Kiefer and Ariel Bibas, two children who were abducted on October 7th and died while in captivity. There had also been mounting indications, soon borne out, that the current ceasefire with Hamas would unravel. The protesters waved Israeli flags and held up signs, 59 more to go, a reference to the hostages still in Gaza in both English and Hebrew. I did not see any signs in Arabic. Tamar Herman, a senior fellow at the Israel Democracy Institute, told me that Arab citizens had been absent from the start. One of the main concerns of the protesters was to show that they are very patriotic, that they served in the army, that they are Zionists, she said. the inclusion of Arabs could have painted them all as leftists, so as collaborators and whatnot. So although certain Arabs leaders are invited, they were not the more outspoken leaders. It was not a joint Jewish-Arab protest. Hassan Jabarin, the director of Abla, a human rights organization, told me that after October 7th, Palestinian citizens concerned about the infliction of collective punishment on Gaza led a demonstration in the northern town of Al-Fam. 100 police officers made 11 arrests. Since then, he said, licenses for protests in the north have been denied. Meanwhile, Netanyahu announced that the war now had four fronts: Gaza, Lebanon, the West Bank, and within. Scores of Palestinian citizens were brought before disciplinary committees or hauled into custody for alleged incitement. Fears of internal violence weren't unreasonable. In May 2021, riots had erupted in some mixed cities, sparked partly in response to a government effort to evict Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah, a neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The lack of bloody clashes in those cities after October 7th suggests that the Hamas attack didn't inflame the same divisions and might eventually have initially fostered solidarity across ethnic lines. Two scholars at the University of Haifa, Duran Nevot and Hannah Daib, are conducting a research project for which they have interviewed dozens of Palestinian citizens, teachers, lawyers, doctors, journalists. Their subject statements provide some evidence to support this notion. Many of them said that they immediately after October 7th, they felt sympathy for the victims, some of whom were residents of their own communities. "We lost people," a Bedouin from the Negev said, "but being treated as an enemy soon created alienation and resentment. I go into Jewish schools and hear the students whispering that I'm Arab," one subject said. This is racism that existed before October 7th, but now it's out in the open. In January 2024, ACORD, an Israeli nonprofit that studies social psychology, released the results of a survey showing that among Jewish Israelis, there had been a sharp rise in anger, fear, and hatred toward Arabs. Ron Gerlitz, ACORD's director, told me that it would have been surprising if we didn't see this. Recent surveys indicate that the animosity has leveled off, but Gerlitz said another ACORD survey found that almost 60% of Jewish Israelis believe it's illegitimate to identify as both Israeli and Palestinian. The message, Gerlitz said, was that Arabs in Israel can't be Israelis unless they disavow core parts of themselves. One of the participants in Nevat and Daib's study told them, "The Palestinians in Israel lives in constant tension between a desire to belong to the broader society and the realization that this belonging is also conditional." Others said that they no longer wanted to belong and felt that their citizenship was worthless. Nevat and Daib draw a distinction between having formal citizenship rights, which Palestinians in Israel have, and being a citizen. You can have citizenship rights without being a citizen because society excludes you or terrifies you or doesn't recognize you, Nevat told me. If you go to work or to your university and you are terrified to speak up, you may have citizenship rights but not feel like a citizen. Aside from fear, the dominant emotions their subjects expressed were disappointment and anguish, fueled by the widespread indifference they sense from the Jewish public toward the horrors occurring in Gaza, where more than 50,000 residents have been killed and millions have been displaced. Nevat told me that nearly all the subjects of the study had expected Israel to respond harshly to the October 7th attacks, and they accepted this, he said, but they didn't expect that so many Jewish Israelis would support the continuity of the reaction for such a long time. They are shocked by this, and it is one of the reasons they don't talk. It's not only that they are afraid, but they feel there is no one to talk to. I heard echoes of this from a Palestinian citizen of Israel I met one evening in Haifa. After October 7th, she locked her social media accounts and stopped communicating directly with friends in Gaza, worried that even a benign text could make her the target of an investigation. I understand that October 7th meant to the Jewish community. I understand their fear, she said, but I can't understand losing your humanity. In the past, few Palestinian citizens of Israel even considered leaving the country, emphasizing the principle of sumud, or steadfastness, and the imperative to remain on ancestral land. But the woman told me that many people she knew were planning to relocate. Indeed, she and her husband were considering emigrating from Israel next year, once their daughters graduated from high school. I can't see a future here, she said. In this sense, they had something in common with Jewish Israelis, thousands of whom have immigrated to Europe since October 7th because they felt despair about the future. This is where I belong, Kasim Hassan told me in Tamra, where she and Sharaf reside with their children in a house bordered by olive trees. Every year, Sharaf's aunts harvest the trees, which supply the family with food and oil. His family doesn't have legal title to all of their land. The government hasn't accepted their claim to it, even though they've lived there for many decades. At one point, they were forced to pay the government a fee to prevent their house from being demolished. Living in Tamra isn't easy. There are virtually no parks in the town, so when Kasim Hassan's two young daughters want to play in one, she often drives them all the way to Kiryat Balik. Another local problem is crime, which has soared in recent years, fueled by gangs, and many residents feel by the deliberate neglect of the police, which since 2022 has been run, except for a short break, by Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, an ultra-nationalist and unapologetic racist. But Kasim Hassan wasn't going anywhere, even as she acknowledged feeling increasingly isolated, not only by from her Jewish peers, but also from some of her fellow Palestinians, including family members. Her older brother, a successful economist, and her sister, a government lawyer, have repeatedly warned her that her outspokenness could damage not only her career, but theirs. Kasim Hassan has also heard this from her father, who lives in Nazareth. She visits him often, in part to check on his health. He suffers from pulmonary fibrosis. One afternoon, she brought me along, stopping on the way to buy kenef, a cheese pastry. When we arrived, her father was lying on a maroon couch in the living room, with a plastic breathing tube attached to his nose. He told me that he was a graduate of Mekev Yisrael, an agricultural school that prided itself on educating the pioneers of the Zionist movement. At the same time, he noted, I lived those 48 years, and I saw the war with my eyes. I lived in Tyre on the triangle near Kfar Saba, and until now, tears welled up in his eyes, I can't grasp how other people could throw me from my house and live in my place. Kasim Hassan told me that her father would sometimes express pride after hearing her on the radio talking about human rights, but then he'd urge her to censor herself. Kasim Hassan understood his conflicting impulses. He's a Nakba survivor, and he's afraid, she said. Lately, though, she hadn't always been apprising her family of her media appearances. I don't want these comments, she said. I need support. She summarized her dilemma. If I speak up, I might damage someone. Myself, the people around me. If I don't speak up, I can't live. This is what gives me purpose. Since October 7th, a source of comfort to Kasim Hassan has been the devotion of patients she'd feared would abandon her. People like Ellen and Shlomo, who live in Kiryat Balik. Ellen, aged 82, is originally from Philadelphia and is the daughter of a passionate Zionist. Shlomo is a Sabra, an Israeli native, who grew up in Tel Aviv. They both told me that they adored Kasim Hassan. After Kasim Hassan discovered that Ellen had an atrioventricular block, she helped her get a pacemaker before the specialist who could perform the surgery left for the weekend. I know she saved my life, Ellen said. She and Shlomo were aware of Kasim Hassan's political beliefs, which Kasim Hassan told her she didn't conceal from her patients. "I can't hide who I am," Shlomo said to me. "We know she's active." It had never affected the quality of the care they received. "She doesn't look at your collar or your views," Ellen said. "She just cares about you as a person." Kasim Hassan also leaned on such colleagues as Dafa Shoshat, a Jewish endocrinologist I met in Jaffa, outside the offices of Physicians for Human Rights Israel. She and Kasim Hassan were there to record videos that would accompany a new PHRI report, which incorporated interviews with 24 Palestinian medical professionals who had been held at Israeli detention facilities, where many of them said that they had been tortured. According to the report, most had been captured while working in hospitals in Gaza, not while plotting acts of terrorism. Both the Israel Prison Service and the IDF denied the report's allegations. The IDF said that it detained only people suspected of involvement in terrorist activities. Kasim Hassan and Shoshat, the daughter of Yaffa Yarkoni, a legendary Israeli singer, were close, and their friendship had affirmed Yassim Hassan's belief in the importance of forging alliances with Jewish Israelis who shared her values. Shoshat, for her part, was impressed by the courage shown by Kasim Hassan, who was far more vulnerable to attack than were PHRI's Jewish members, and by her gentle fierceness. She somehow manages to say things as they are without apologizing, without compromising, and without losing her dignity and compassion, Shoshat says. She quoted the poet Leah Goldberg, "Even in a time of war, the value of love is greater than the value of murder," and said, "Lena really embodies that." And that's all we have time for today. By A.L. Press. A.L. Press has been writing for The New Yorker since 2014 and became a contributing writer in 2023. He is a Puffin Foundation Fellow at the Type Media Center. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.